Well, greetings again, everyone, and hello to our visitors, some of you from faraway Tulsa and elsewhere, I suppose. Maybe still traveling from after the feast. Is that what's happening here? Or do we just, you're coming down to visit us today on this beautiful Sabbath. We're glad to have you here. You can hear that I'm having a little bit of a head cold. My wife has been down all the way since last Sunday with a flu, and I've been fighting as hard as I know how, you know, just really pouring in the vitamin C, big glasses of grapefruit juice and orange juice and vitamin C tablets and alfalfa and I don't know what else. But everything's supposed to be natural and good for you. And so far, I've been able to ward it off, at least the worst part of it. But it hit my wife so bad that she was just knocked out and on the couch, could hardly get up for a better part of 3 days. And so far, I haven't come down with it. So I appreciate your prayers on that behalf. But that's nowhere near as serious as most of these you just heard about. I think a lot of you were watching television yesterday, were you not? I happened to catch the actual live portion of the speeches that were made by President Clinton introducing Benjamin Netanyahu and later on Yasser Arafat and King Hussein of Jordan. My father met King Hussein on many occasions, and I interviewed his brother Hassan, who is the crown prince, on my last visit over there, and have written, of course, a number of articles over the years about the Middle East and about the ongoing quest for Middle East peace. I've also written an article, just completed it. I have the final with me to give to my son Matthew that I've corrected on the latest World Watch. And I finished another little sketch of something just this morning. I hadn't quite finished yet a part of an article about the Y2K syndrome. I'll get to that in a moment. The title of my article is Why This Interim Peace Agreement Will Not Work. The seeds of World War II were actually planted by the Versailles Treaty and by the attempts of the League of Nations to, for example, strip Germany of all of her East African colonies, of all of the colonies she had in the South Pacific, the Marshalls, the Gilberts, and the rest of them, so that Tanzania and Kenya were taken away, Tanganyika, from the Germans and given to the Allied powers. But, of course, they also took the port of Danzig, and they gave that to the Poles. It was an argument over access to the North Sea and Danzig, and it was called the Danzig Corridor. Well, now, if you look at the gerrymander, the way the map is going to look in this business of allegedly trading land for peace, I think you would have to go back and get an almanac from about 1965, and they're available in public libraries, or a map of that period, and most of them will shade it so you can see the pre-1967 borders of Israel and the subsequent 1967 borders following the Six-Day War. I was there in 1966, just before that war. I was in Egypt and saw all of the marshalling yards, the loggers, they're called, for the thousands of tanks that Egypt was getting ready to launch that assault. We went through Lebanon, and I picked up an almanac because I was doing articles and broadcasts from some of the Middle Eastern countries as I went along, and I wanted an almanac to refresh my memory about certain statistics, demographics, population distribution, etc. I tried to turn to Israel, and the page wouldn't work. It wouldn't separate. And I looked at the page numbers, and there were three pages that were sort of stuck together. Well, I kept trying to get them apart, and finally I realized I couldn't get them apart, that the Lebanese bookseller had glued them together so that there was no Israel. Israel didn't exist. And this has been the attitude, and I relate that to you to help you understand a little of the circumstances over there and what is happening and what is probably going to happen in the next few months and years. They finally, by dragging PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat virtually yelling and kicking, got him to agree as one of the steps to revising the PLO Charter, which blatantly calls for the annihilation of Israel, the destruction of Israel. But they have got to have the full council meeting, and of course that hasn't taken place yet, and Yasser Arafat has not got the full support of all of the Palestinians. The PLO is not the only Palestinian group, nor has Benjamin Netanyahu got the full support of the Israelis, nor his own government. The right-wingers, and I've written on that in World Watch, including the Orthodox Jews and most of the religious right, have even threatened to walk out and bring down the government as a result of what Netanyahu signed yesterday. Netanyahu is a prime candidate, as is Yasser Arafat,
for assassination. I mentioned in the article that while they're talking about Israeli security, it might be advisable for Benjamin Netanyahu to see to his own security. Because what I thought was a very dear friend of mine, a man that you couldn't help to like and have a real affinity for, Yitzhak Rabin, with whom I spent a good deal of time on several occasions and interviewed when he was running for his second time around as the Prime Minister of Israel, is now, of course, moldering away in his coffin as a result of trying to implement what he explained to me, a three-part, step-by-step pullback of redeployment on the West Bank and trading land for peace. And he was murdered by a right-wing Israeli fanatic who wanted them to hang on to every inch of the land they have gained in the 1967 war and a lot of territory beside. Land for peace? Think about it. I'm leading up to the prophecies of Jesus Christ, Matthew 24 and Luke 21, and we know that what Christ says is going to occur in the Middle East is virtually another Holocaust. There is not good news in the Christian Bible, in Matthew 24, for the modern nation of Israel. I've been there many times. My son Mark was the manager of our office over there and spent the better part of 2 years in Jerusalem. And when you've been to the Western Wall and you've seen those huge stones, some of them as large as half of this wall here, that fit so conformably and perfectly together you can barely get a razor blade between the joints. And then you look at the statement of Jesus Christ, I tell you the time is coming when there shall not remain here one stone atop another that has not been prized loose or that has not fallen down. And there are many stones atop another that were there as Jesus himself walked around in those very environs. The temple itself was destroyed, that's true, but not every stone. So you run headlong into whether or not that forerunner or that typical destruction of Jerusalem in 71 AD by the armies of Titus really fulfilled all of Matthew 24, or is it dual? Well, it's either dual, and much of it remains to be fulfilled, or else Christ didn't know what he was talking about, and the Bible isn't true. And there is no God, and you can't depend upon any verse of the Bible because much of Matthew 24 describes the second coming of Christ, describes the great tribulation, the heavenly signs, the day of the Lord, talks about an abomination of desolation standing in the holy place where it ought not. And none of that has been fulfilled yet. So if that is yet to be fulfilled, and we believe it is, then there is not good news ahead for the Israelis living in the nation of modern-day Israel. It was hailed with all of the usual hoopla and the foo-furrah and all of the rhetoric about peace and goodwill and our children and children's children and everybody loving one another. But did you look, if you're watching carefully, the body language? Did you look at Netanyahu looking down like this and just looking like he was almost wincing with every word that Yasser Arafat said? Did you listen to Yasser Arafat going on and on and on until twice I saw Clinton go like that, like he was falling asleep and barely able to recover himself? And on one occasion, Netanyahu did the same thing. I did it at home, and I wanted to watch. I was listening to this man in Arabic and listening to the interpreter. He went on and on. He said the same thing about five or six different ways, and he must have taken something like 40 minutes to Netanyahu's 12 or 15, and went on and on and on. All the fair speeches, peace, peace, says Jeremiah, when there is no peace. Now, you know what the deal is. They're supposed to release about 750 deadly, murdering terrorists out of Israeli jails and let them run around free in the Palestinian Authority areas. They're supposed to provide two highways of complete access back and forth between this divided new state, which eventually will be unilaterally declared, no doubt, perhaps by May of next year. I'll talk about that, too, I hope, if I get to it with all the things in my mind, but I want to give you a parallel between that and the unilateral declaration of Israel in 1948 and why it would not behoove Israel to attack the new Palestinian state if they do decide that the old city is going to be their capital, which they no doubt will. But also a part of the deal was that they're going to open an airport down in the Gaza Strip. They're going to begin to build a seaport, so they will have a seaport and an airport, and they can begin to export and import, and they can begin to hopefully stimulate their economy, such as it is. The American CIA is supposed to send any number of operatives over there who no doubt will be of Israeli and or Arabic background. We'll try to ferret out some of the illegal arms caches and some of the underground fringe elements of Hamas and Black September and some of the other groups who are continually waging war. The leader of Hamas quoted, as a result of these 9 days of meetings at the Y plantation, has said there is no way that they're going to abandon their military objective. And already the fringe groups over there, both Israeli and Palestinian, are shrieking and screaming about this deal that was signed over there yesterday in the White House. So, as I look at the entire scenario and all the fair speeches and the heads of state talking about peace, and I look at this very fragile agreement where several times they nearly got up and walked out, where one day before they signed it, they had called the Israeli delegation to their airplane, told the pilot to fire up the APU, the engines, it's actually the, not the engine, I won't go into that, that's technical, but anyway. They were getting the aircraft ready to go, and they were packing their bags. Now, Clinton needed a victory, and so, of course, Clinton stayed there tirelessly, and you've got to hand him that. And I don't care what you say about Clinton, he is very intelligent. He does have tremendous retention of what he reads, and he has a grasp of the situation around him, and at least he had the tenacity to stay there and to try to bring off what to him is a fabulous coup, a fabulous victory, which will only enhance his ratings, which they are hoping will be the main determinant factor in the congressional impeachment hearings to persuade these Republicans not to go back to their voters' constituency and so on, and to blackball Clinton. Now, those of us, you, we, me, anybody that likes to take another tack or tends to be very, very conservative, all of our views notwithstanding, you've got to say it's a smart ploy on his part. He needed a victory, and he's got it. It won't last long, but probably it will last through the elections in November, and it may mean an awful lot of difference for what some of us hope the outcome will be with regard to Republican and Democrat members of Congress and the entire House. I wanted to interject something right quickly. When I first stood up here, I was going to do this, and I'll just interject it now. My last program on WGN has resulted in more than 500, probably approaching 600 responses if you count the website responses, and well more than 300 here. And I just got this morning from Chris. He said, you were right in your Monday report when you stated we were breaking records for all time here on the EA website. Monday we had 400 visitors, the best Monday ever, and the best day ever. Tuesday, 302 visitors, best Tuesday ever. Wednesday, 273, best Wednesday ever. Thursday, 248, the best Thursday ever. Friday, 275, the best Friday ever. And that's 1,499 in the last 5 days. And he said, many, many positive emails about the feast from all sites, and the stories of love, family, and joy are consistent throughout. Lots of indication of rededication to personal growth and to the work. And my son David told us that just since he's come home from the feast and processing the mail that he's gone through, there are 150 brand new first-time donors who never contributed before. One of them contributed $1,000, and one of them contributed $700, and we'd never even heard from them before. So that is excellent growth, and I want to pass that along to those along the tape program as well. When my wife and I stopped temporarily in the Denver airport to change planes and to go on to Reno to drive up to Tahoe during the feast, I saw a headline that caught my eye, so I picked up the paper and read it. On that very day, a cult had disappeared from Denver, Colorado. The guy's name is Kim something. I've forgotten, but I was writing about it, and I got that name and was writing about it just this morning in connection with this other article I had for World Watch. They have not yet been found. Their family and loved ones and former members of the cult are very concerned. They think it is another one of these suicide pacts that they're going to enact. When I have written extensively on Y2K, a couple of times I had predicted that that would occur. My wife handed me a little caution. She said, you think you should really put that in there? Meaning, will it give people ideas? I said, yes, I think I should put it in there. I don't think that people are going to go commit suicide because I say they shouldn't. But in any event, I went ahead and I put it in there. I'm glad I did. Here's the news from Israel. Already, there are many, many Americans coming into Israel on one-way tickets. Already, an article, a major article in the London Times said that Israel is gearing up to watch for these people because they've disappeared, they've gone to Mexico, and I don't think there are more than about 60 or so of them, And the guy who was their leader believes that he is, see if this rings a bell, going to die in the streets of Jerusalem. But he'll only be dead for 3 days and three nights. And then he's going to be resurrected. And, of course, any of the people who die with him will also be resurrected. Who does he think he is? Well, he thinks he's one of the more than 47 people who have introduced themselves to me as the two witnesses. He thinks he's one of those, one of the two witnesses. If you will turn to the book of Revelation, chapter 11, I want to go through this with you and we'll read up to it. I want to tell you right now, I am not one of the two witnesses. It is not Ron and Ted. It's not Rod and Ron. It's not Rod and Ted. It's not Gerald and Ted. It's not Gerald and Rod. It's not, Amos and Andy or anybody else. It is no one that you know, as far as I'm aware. I absolutely deny any such appellations attached to me. In chapter 11, verse 1, John, remember, was projected forward in vision, and what he saw was in the mind's eye like a technicolor dream. There was given to me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel said, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. Now, how do you measure people, except to say he's 5'9", weighs 160, but this is all metaphorical, and it's all in a vision. But the court which is without the temple leave out and measure it not. And there's a reason for that. For it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. Now then, historically, that is understood by many of the commentaries, and was certainly understood by us for many, many years, as being interpreted by looking at the 1,260 years that transpired during the time of history from certain dates that Dr. Herman Hay established, from certain persecutions against the church, and were supposed to be exactly parallel with the times of the Gentiles. And that when the times of the Gentiles were complete, then, of course, all these prophetic occurrences were going to take place. 42 months is a literal time of 3.5 years. But when you look into all the prophecies having to do with the state of the people of the 12 tribes of Israel at the time of the second coming of Christ, if you were to have a piece of paper, a map, or a chart, or a blackboard, and you draw an imaginary line, a great big line, big red or big black line, you just label it second coming of Christ. Then you extrapolate backwards. You just work backwards from it. And you know that you have an indeterminate period of time between the 1335 and the 1290 and the 1260. And you're not quite sure how to deal with that, perhaps, and I'm not either. Not yet. We probably will come to understand that a little later out of Daniel 12 and the last portion of it. But you do know that for 3.5 years, Israel is in a state of captivity. You also know that for 3.5 years, the holy city is trodden underfoot of the Gentiles. You also know that for 3.5 years, the ministry of the two witnesses is taking place. And that these are all the same period of time. Now, when it says that they will tread it underfoot 42 months, the way that that was looked at in the past was that since there was originally a wooden structure called the Mosque of Omar, which was built after they cleared away the rubble following the sack of Jerusalem in 71 A.D. And as the sword of Islam, and this took centuries to develop, if you study the history of Muhammad and the development of the Islamic religion, it took many centuries for them to actually conquer throughout the Middle East and to get rid of the Christian communities in places like Alexandria and Jerusalem and to begin to really dominate that part of the world under Saladin and some of the great heroes of the Islamic faith. But eventually that big mosque was built on the site where they claim Muhammad went to heaven. Now remember, the Muhammadan religion or the Islamic religion didn't really get a real good foothold until 600 years after Christ. So it's way after the time of the Council of Nicaea. But eventually this Mosque of Omar was built, and then eventually it was replaced by the structure that stands there today, which is called the Dome of the Rock, made out of stone with actual gold leaf on its dome, which is one of the most famous skylines in all of the world. So it was interpreted by people that since Gentiles have control of the Temple Mount, that they are treading down the Temple Mount, and there is no temple there. And so it's understood by people historically as having happened for all this time. And I've written also an article about the fiasco of Gershon Salomon, who tried one more time, for the eighth time, to lay a cornerstone and was barred by Israeli police from getting in the Mugrabi gate, and so they just circled around the old city like they said they would do for seven times, blowing on ram's horns, but then they were turned away. No riot developed because police presence was very, very heavy, and Gershon Salomon failed in his attempt to lay a symbolic cornerstone. A few days ago, two Americans were arrested at the Tel Aviv airport because it was determined they had landed in Israel, determined to blow up the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Many years ago, a young man who subsequently became a member of the CGI in Australia had gone into that area and thrown firebombs into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, got himself arrested. It's a miracle he wasn't murdered. And eventually, I don't know how much time he did, but was deported back to Australia. And I don't know if he had a Plain Truth magazine in his pocket when he went in there and threw that firebomb or not. But one of the important reasons I want to talk to you about this is for disclaimer purposes. I do not believe for one instant that any human being is supposed to go out and try to take into his own hands biblical prophecy and try to write self-fulfilling prophecies. The psychiatrists, the medical fraternity, and the police in Jerusalem today are well aware of what is called the Jerusalem syndrome. Millions of Americans and Western Europeans and Britons and Germans and everybody else of the so-called Christian professing Western world have gone to Jerusalem to make pilgrimages to what they call the holy places. And they sometimes get afflicted with what is called the Jerusalem syndrome. Going over there and looking at what they've always read about, and they've always heard about, oh, that's the Mount of Olives, oh, wow, you know, that's Golgotha, or that's the Sea of Galilee, and so on. They suddenly get imbued with what the psychiatrists are calling the Jerusalem syndrome. And they begin to see themselves as being far more important in God's sight than they were before they got there. Then they begin to see themselves as having some special mission to fulfill or to carry out. And in its extreme cases, they decide to make a firebomb and destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Well, that is idiocy. It is stupidity. It is, of course, potentially, not only is it arson and horrible property damage, but could trigger a war in which hundreds of thousands or even millions of people could die because of the response by all of the Arab nations if some fanatic were to destroy those mosques. So, you know, the Israelis are girding up. Now, here's the mess you're going to look at by 2000. 5 million people, mostly Americans, are expected in Jerusalem on January 1st, 2000. Pilgrims. 5 million. Israel is gearing up for 5 million people. One man said the other day, if a lot of these people come over and they simply park on and squat on the Mount of Olives, and then when Christ doesn't show up, they're going to dig in and wait it out. Then what are we going to do? How does the Israeli government handle masses of people like that? There aren't enough chemi cans and porta potties in all of Israel to take care of the mess those people are going to make. But there are people who are going to go over there and do exactly that. So, you know, human beings with some of these notions and attitudes they get in their mind can create an awful lot of problems. Now, the London Times article to which I referred states that the Israeli immigration authorities and the police are really keeping a careful watch because they know that apparently this cult that disappeared out of Denver is hiding out in Mexico, and they're trying to find some means to sneak into some back door some way or another to get into Jerusalem because they want to be there for the great event. Now, the man is a false prophet. He's a nut, a fruitcake, and an idiot because he already claimed that as of two Sabbaths ago, Denver was to have been destroyed by a huge earthquake. Denver's still there. And you think the followers are going to leave him? No, they're just, oh, well, he'll just revise it. Well, oops, we goofed. Let's see. How do we figure this out? But now, he is doing this because he wants a place in history. Let's see, quick. What was the name of the guy that caused all of the people in San Diego to put the plastic over their heads? What was his name? See there? You don't know? I don't either, and I don't care. But he has a place in history. Right? I guess, but I don't even know his name. And I don't care. What was the guy that years ago wrote the book about the Rapture 1987? And it didn't happen. Then he wrote a new one, Rapture 1988. And it didn't happen. And he didn't work on 89. He just disappeared somewhere. Well, he didn't go down in history. Well, they say, the people that study these cults, that this man is going to do this like Jim Jones did and lead these people over there probably to their deaths, because he has decided that he has a particular thing that he is supposed to fulfill and to go down in history as dying in the streets of Jerusalem. Now, he might be able to provoke those Arabs into killing him, or he might be able to provoke the Israeli soldiers into killing him, but if he can't provoke them into murdering him in the streets by January 1st of 2000, he's just going to have to commit suicide. But I just think that when I say watch Jerusalem, and I do quite often, you can see the reason for it. If you didn't believe there is a God, if we were a group of atheists meeting here today, then what I'm telling you about Y2K and the cult and about the pact that was signed yesterday and about the Palestinians and Israelis and about the Arabs surrounding Jerusalem is still true, isn't it? I mean, except for the prophetic scenario we're talking about out in the future, everything I'm talking about is happening. It's real. All right, he says, I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. No suits, no ties, clothed in sackcloth. Will that be literal? As I said somewhat jocularly during the feast, I don't think they're going to go to Brooks Brothers and order burlap suits. But there will be, apparently, people who literally will not have any clothing and be clothed in some kind of garb that they can simply pick up out of a garbage can or something. These are the two olive trees, and if you look at your marginal reference there, you will go back to Zechariah 4 and verse 3, and the two candlesticks, and again, that was metaphor, standing before the God of the earth, and if any man will hurt them, fire proceeds out of their mouth and devours their enemies. Is that literal? Like a fire swallower, a man that has Ronsonol and lights it while he spews it out of his mouth in the carnival? I think it's metaphorical. I think it has to do with a command, just like in the case of Elijah when he was up on the hill and the captains of 50 came and he said, if I be a man of God, then God will take care of it. And fire came down and destroyed the man and the 50. And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. These have power to shut heaven that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, and have power over waters to turn them to blood and to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will. What an incredible responsibility. Smiting the earth with plagues, turning water to blood, means mass death. It means hundreds of thousands, if not millions, are going to die. Now, when Moses and Aaron, Moses, the very reluctant prophet, went back into Egypt to deliver those people, remember that he stuttered and stammered and said, I can't talk. And he said, I will make Aaron your mouthpiece, and he will go with you to do the speaking. So it was Aaron that did the speaking, even though Moses is always given the credit for it. Moses said unto Pharaoh, he didn't really, Aaron did, but it was Moses there in charge, and so Pharaoh gave the speech. And you've seen, you've been through many times in your lifetime, all of the great plagues that Moses and Aaron caused to fall upon Egypt, and the magicians who through demonic sleight of hand, demonic spiritist, miraculous events of some kind, were able to duplicate those plagues right up until the lice. There were so many hundreds of millions of lice, there weren't enough demons to even begin to duplicate it, apparently, but they duplicated the frogs and a lot of the other plagues through demonic and satanic power. But eventually they had to say to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. I have seen that there is a direct parallel here. Since Israel is going to be in a condition of captivity, when I say Israel, I think, and I'm looking at that, as the modern day nations of America, Britain, of Denmark, Norway, Sweden, of Holland, of certainly the northern half of France, if not all of France, of Belgium, of Switzerland, and so on. But even if you don't believe that, and it doesn't matter if you don't, because it's not essential for you to believe that to get into the kingdom of God. You don't have to know that to inherit God's kingdom. A prophet of God, an evangelist who's going to preach the kingdom of God and to understand prophecy, needs to understand that. But if you don't, then who can you say is Israel? Well, get a map or an almanac. Israel is Israel. So even if you just think it's Israel, over there in the Middle East, it's still an enormous, important prophecy, Because why do you think the President of the United States, even if he had not been under the terrible cloud he's under, would spend those 9 days all night long until it dawns when they watch the sun go down when they were arguing and wrangling the night before, trying to hammer out some kind of a tenuous peace agreement in that region of the world unless it were very, very important? I think if that had been George Bush there, he'd have done the same thing. I think it had been Eisenhower, he'd done the same thing, because they know what is at stake. They know what is at stake for the rest of the world. Pakistan has the nuclear bomb. India has the nuclear bomb. Iran is working on the nuclear bomb. The Osirak plant at Iraq, right near Baghdad, that was bombed out of existence in 1986 by the Israeli F-16s, was well along toward producing nuclear weapons. Israel has at least 1,000 one-plus kiloton range nuclear bombs, and that is known. Now, we know that advanced Scuds are being delivered to Syria. We know that advanced Scuds are being worked on by Iran. Iran fired a test rocket the other day. And we know that those warheads can be equipped with chemical or biological weapons. And that the Middle East is festooned with such weapons all around Israel. So the outbreak of another major war, other than just terrorists throwing grenades at school buses or Israeli passengers standing around a bus as they did down at Beersheba the other day, 25 soldiers injured, 22 civilians were injured, some of them critically. No one was killed, no one has died yet, but people lost eyes and parts of their bodies. But these terrorist acts are one thing, but a massive armed attack from several Arab states at the same time would be something altogether different, and far different than it was in 1973 at the Yom Kippur War when Egypt broached the Barlev line. That was conventional warfare. It does not, there is no guarantee that the next round of war in the Middle East would be limited to conventional weapons. And that's what everyone is really terrified about, really worried about. The specter of gassing Jews is so horrible to contemplate that I remind you once again, and I've said it many times, of the retired Air Force general in Israel who was orbiting in a light plane over Jerusalem with an American Western correspondent who was writing about the scene over there. And he said, before we Jews will ever again be led like so many sheep to the cattle cars, we will pull down the temple of humanity. And what he meant by that is obviously we have the weapons to do it. We can turn Baghdad or Cairo into glass. And the Israeli Air Force is perfectly capable of doing precisely that, probably within 20 minutes' notice. So because of this, it's no wonder that the President of the United States and all of the leaders of the big powers of this world are very interested in seeing to it that the Middle East calms down. Now, when you understand a lot of the Jewish community in the United States, of who they are, of how powerful they are, you're not just dealing with a Jewish political lobby. Do you understand that much of the world's economy is run by Jews? I'm not anti-Israeli. I'm not anti-Jewish. I'm telling you that in Holland, in all the nations of Western Europe and all around the world, with the exception of Japan and the periphery of Southeast Asia and Central South America, but most of the English-speaking countries of the world, you will find that the Jews have their hands on the banks, the financial institutions, the insurance companies, all of the big moneyed industries. They control the diamonds. They control the gold. They control the silver. All the diamonds in the world come out of De Beers and, of course, in West Africa, and certain other places here and there, but they go via Amsterdam to Tel Aviv and to New York, and they're all Jewish. So the really massive amount of money in the world is controlled, and therefore the economies of many nations, by people that are in great sympathy with Israel. It's not only that the United States is a mentor and provider of Israeli support, and that we send massive amounts of aid to Israel every single year, the largest by far of any other nation, and that no doubt Clinton would have to pull out that stick and threaten Netanyahu with it on any number of occasions. Well, we'll just clamp down the aid. You remember Netanyahu's speech last year before Congress and the tremendous applause he got when he showed their incremental plan where their economy was supposed to grow to the point to where they would actually become self-sufficient, would not have to depend anymore upon American aid? And the minute he did that, the whole Congress just broke out with a lot of applause. Oh, good, we don't have to send all those hundreds of millions over to Israel anymore. Now, I want you to think about the following scenario. First of all, the two roads, the access. There are going to be incidents. There are going to be an awful lot of checkpoints. There are going to be a lot of problems involving those two roads, and there are going to be wrangles about it. There's going to be an awful lot of argument about it. The CIA agents, who will they be? What will they do? Who will control them? There are going to be an awful lot of arguments about that. The time when the full council is to convene to look at the PLO charter and to take out the paragraphs offensive to Israel calling for their extermination, their annihilation, and denying them the right to exist. There's going to be an awful lot of wrangling about that. Each one of these very tenuous steps that they're taking is rife with the potential of a lot of argument. This is not a peace pact, not a peace treaty. It is an interim agreement. And it does nothing except reaffirm what they said in Oslo a long time ago. There's nothing new in it. It's trying to push the Israelis into a more rapid redeployment, pullback from the West Bank. Now let me put you into a brief little historical scenario. Most of you know it maybe, so I'll just try to hurry. Remember the Yom Kippur War. You remember that they attacked Israel on the Day of Atonement, which is one of their greatest, most important national holidays, and many of them, not all of them, do fast. Well, on the first several days of that war, it lasted for a little more than 6 days, the Israelis were being pushed back and taking heavy losses on every front. The Egyptians crossed the Suez Canal. They broached the Bar-Lev line, which was 100 miles long, with certain checkpoints and hardened points, bunkers every several miles. It wasn't a solid wall. It was mostly a huge berm of sand, but there were concrete emplacements every so often along that line, and then, of course, roadways behind it where their tanks and APCs could run back and forth. The tank columns numbering, and you forget this, I guess, but literally, believe it or not, there was never a tank battle in all of World War II that even began to approach the numbers of tanks involved between the Syrian and the Israeli tank battles in the Golan Heights. It's fact. There were far more thousands of tanks involved than the Battle of the Bulge or any other major tank battle of World War II. Now, they were pushed back past Kuneitra Trough, and they had their back to the wall. They were suffering a tremendous loss. Hundreds of young Israelis were being blasted away by these big Russian tanks. In the meantime, they were advancing toward the Mitla Pass, and the whole Egyptian Third Army had been ferried across the Suez Canal with hastily erected pontoon bridges. Well, there was a man who many years previously had come up with a weird idea of huge big rollers in several different pieces, which would be very, very flexible, and a huge big bridge, which was exactly the length of the distance across the Suez Canal. And he had some of these rollers prefabbed and manufactured here in the United States. And the company that did it didn't know what they were for, but the Israelis made it look like they were some kind of a caisson or something for some other kind of a business. And they ferried them over into Israel and got them there. And here is this contraption in the last few days of that war, rolling over the dunes, every now and then getting out of control and crunching into a tank, and they had to repair it. But those huge big rollers were also like pontoons. And once the bridge began to go into the water, the roller just flipped up, just like water wings on each side. And then the rolls just kept on rolling, and the front part of it began to float. And the Israelis managed, with this weird-looking, never-before-seen, otherworldly contraption, to push this huge bridge across the Suez Canal, and the tanks and APCs began rumbling across. Well, they got behind the Egyptian Third Army that stuck over in the Sinai. The Israelis went south of where they were, broached that canal, went across into Egypt, and were heading up toward Suez and Cairo, and it outflanked the Egyptian Third Army. The Russians had already said they were going to enter into the war if America entered into the war. Do you remember the gas lines, 1973? Do you remember the oil embargo, 1973? You know why it came about, of course. Well, the Russian Antonov, if you've ever studied those huge aircraft, much bigger than a C-5A, by the way. The Russians built the biggest aircraft the world has ever seen. And they would take care of several tanks and hundreds of troops, and they had a whole batch of them loaded on the runways, ready to go to land inside Syria and to help the Syrians crush Israel. The American intelligence community knew exactly what was happening. So Nixon went halfway. Instead of transshipping any supplies, because the Israelis were screaming, we're out of tanks, we're out of APCs, we've lost hundreds and hundreds of men, and we need resupply, Nixon decided to simply borrow tanks and APCs from forward NATO bases, put them aboard C-5As, and he started landing at Lod near Tel Aviv. Now, the satellites from both Russians and Americans could spot what was happening in the southern desert on the other side of Suez. And so the big powers agreed, let's put the pressure on all parties and let's get this thing stopped. For several days, they wrangled about whether or not a humanitarian airlift or a humanitarian convoy could go from Cairo across that Israeli bridge to feed those starving and burning up Third Army Egyptian soldiers, because they were completely cut off, their supplies were gone, and they were going to perish to a man, and the Israelis could have wiped them out. That was the bargaining chip. So the Israelis said, yes, we'll let a humanitarian convoy through, but that's all. And so eventually, peace was proclaimed once again. Now look what the Israelis did in the wake of that. When I visited with Anwar Sadat, he was so proud, and just a few days ago, well, actually on Yom Kippur, the Egyptian government threw a huge parade, and here was Hosni Mubarak standing up in this car, going along, and behind him were hundreds of tanks and tens of thousands of soldiers waving the Egyptian flag, celebrating Yom Kippur as a great victory for the Egyptians. Because they broached the Bar-Lev line, they went over into the Sinai, and look what they got afterward. Now that's what I'm coming to. After the 67 war, all of those territories that were held by the Arab nations, Syria had the Golan Heights, Egypt had the Gaza Strip and the Sinai, Jordan had the West Bank. Now Israel has the West Bank, the Golan Heights and the Gaza Strip, which pointed like a knife into the soft underbelly of Israel and would allow Egyptian tank columns to be within just minutes of Israel rumbling up there on the highways. Israel had developed from 67 until 73 the oil-producing facilities of the Sinai, and had actually become oil self-sufficient and an oil exporter. That meant a tremendous help to the Israeli economy. But in order to get peace with Egypt, I've told you about my talk with Sadat, I won't divert into that, and how he went over to see Begin. In order to get peace, because they just so desperately don't want to see any more of their women and children and civilians being blasted to bits by suicide bombers and by grenades and bombs aboard buses, they said, we'll give it all back. And they gave the entire Sinai back to Egypt as a part of the Camp David Accords to get a signed peace treaty, not an interim agreement, with Egypt. They gave back Sharm el-Sheikh, the fortress that overlooked the entrance into the southern part of the Red Sea, a very strategic military high point. They gave back all those oil-producing facilities. The Israelis don't have the Gidi or the Mitla passes anymore, those narrow rocky defiles where they annihilated the Egyptian tanks back in 1967. They don't have any of the Sinai anymore. It all belongs to Egypt. They gave it back. You hear them talk about security. I think all of you know, or maybe you don't, Latrun, I've been there many times, 12 miles from that narrow waist of Israel, from 48 to 67, separated the Jordanian Desert Legion from the Mediterranean Ocean. Here was Haifa and Tel Aviv, and down here was a little narrow corridor leading to only the western part of Jerusalem. And tanks could have negotiated that little corridor in barely over a half an hour. Now, because they don't want to be subject to that kind of massed armor attacks against civilians, and to look at the threat of virtual annihilation, the Israelis are trying to incrementally, little by little, trade a little bit of land for peace. It's not going to succeed. You can hail their efforts. Yitzhak Rabin was a fine man in a lot of ways, and remember that he was a general during many of their wars, and he was also their defense minister, as well as being the prime minister on two occasions. He was shot down by a fanatical young Hebrew, young Jew, who didn't believe in giving back any of that territory for peace, but believed in just the right-wing Israeli Zionist approach that they ought to kick the Arabs out and annihilate all of them like David did to the Jebusites, Hivites, Perizzites, and the Canaanites and the Philistines. And that's the way a lot of people read the Old Testament over there, and they believe that's the way the modern Israelis ought to conduct themselves toward the Arab. Just get rid of them. So if anyone thinks that a signature on a piece of paper is going to change the heart and the mind, the mindset of generations of these Palestinian Arabs, they've got another think coming. It's simply not going to happen. That's all there is to it. There are very terrible times ahead for those people over there. And I, because I've been in both camps, in other words, I've been in private homes in Amman in Jordan, been entertained by people who are wealthy enough to have lovely big homes over there and put out quite a table, and have met doctors, one dentist, I met the head of Birzeit, their university, I met the leaders of the Palestinian movement, not Arafat, but the others over there, Husseini, whom you've seen many a time on television, and they're people just like us, but they've got their ideas, spiritual and political. And you see their little children running around, you don't wish harm to those children. And you don't wish harm to little Israeli children. You just wish people could live at peace. But as far as the religious aspect is concerned, and all these many, many decades of these people hating one another, and each terrorist attack or retaliation simply becomes the latest one for which they seek additional vengeance. And it's just like the Hatfields and McCoys, the twain are never going to meet, and they will never get through with it all. Well, let's go back to this right quickly, because it says that these two witnesses who are going to be in Jerusalem, and remember, they're going to be there at a horrible time, after all organized preaching of the gospel has come to an end, and after, really, not that the great tribulation is over, but the tribulation is interrupted by the heavenly signs, and then comes the day of the Lord. And apparently, during the tribulation, during the heavenly signs, and during the day of the Lord, for that whole 3 1/2 year period, there are going to be two human beings. Are they born yet? Are they in their 20s or 40s? Are they older men? Some people have come up with some of the weirdest scenarios. Some people have claimed, well, these two witnesses are the New Testament and the Old Testament. Well, it says their dead bodies lie in the street. I mean, some of the weirdest interpretation that people have put upon this. They're obviously two men, just like Moses and Aaron, just like Elijah and Elisha, and just like the Apostle Paul and Peter or someone else. Human prophets who are going to be going to the headquarters of the beast and the false prophet and to continually tell them, as Moses and Aaron did, let my people go, don't persecute my people, don't keep killing Americans and Britons and Norwegians and Danes and Swiss and Frenchmen and so on, or thus and such is going to happen to you. Now, if you look at all of the prophecies of this period of time, of the entire Middle East, of how a northern power is going to come into Palestine. In this case, I think if you read Matthew 24 and you look at the language of Jesus when he says, let him that is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his home, or he that is in the field return not to get anything out of his house, that it seems to be something which is in place, but which suddenly changes in its nature. So that they see some troops moving around, or they see some tanks coming down the street where they shouldn't be, not that they've got a week or 10 days or a month of some kind of calling to arms of the reserves and some big power. And we know through satellite and instant telecommunication in the world today, there's plenty of advance warning. Look at NATO giving them advance warning for Kosovo if they're going to attack over there and let them disperse all their assets if they want to all over the countryside. So it seems to be that there will be an occupying army in place. And when he says, when you see these things begin to come to pass, then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains, and let him that is on the housetop not come back into his house to get anything, or him that is in the field not come back into his house. Now, I've told you time and again, when you put this all together, you remember that only about 2.5-3 years ago, the Israelis exchanged ambassadages with the Vatican. And that the Pope has been calling time and time again for a corpus separatum, or an internationalized city. Now we have what is really yet to be placed on the table, the creation of a Palestinian state. It'll be completely divided, a little increment here and a big chunk over there, with a little roadway or two leading between it. Absolutely just begging for trouble to ever have a state divided by another state in the first place. Remember the Danzig Corridor. Now use your mind. Why cannot Israel immediately, if Yasser, declares Yasser Arafat unilaterally an independent Palestinian state, why can't Israel just attack them? Because of what happened in 1948. Because Israel declared unilaterally, we are a state, and the United States said, we recognize you. And then other nations, very begrudgingly, little by little, came on board, and it took years for most of them to ever recognize them, and most of the Arab states have never done so to this moment, with the exception of Egypt and Jordan, and now they're arguing about it, maybe the PLO. But the others still don't recognize them as a state. They glue together the pages that shows that they're there. So they wouldn't dare attack. But they will also do this, and Yasser Arafat promises to do it, that they're going to declare that the old city with its holy places is their capital. Then you're going to have real problems. Will that set the stage for papal intervention? Will the Pope go there first, or will the armies go first and protect the Pope and ensconce him in a holy place? Will a temple be built first, or a symbolic cornerstone in some kind of a temporary structure dedicating it, which will satisfy the biblical prophecy when you see the abomination of desolation stand in the holy place where it ought not? But we are in the offing. We're on the cusp of events occurring in biblical prophecy that are going to be very, very important. Now, I know basically what I've done with you here today is to go back through a little bit of history and to talk about current news, and to give you some projections of what might occur in the near future. But it behooves us to watch that, and I think that what I heard here and there about certain people that are beginning to negate prophecy and talk down about it and are abandoning the requirement of God's people to act as God's watchmen and to watch, as Christ said, and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that are going to come to pass. I can't help but watch. There's no way that I can turn away from the kind of a television program yesterday when I have been to those areas so often, and it's such a vital part of what I believe and I expect is going to happen in world conditions. So just keep watching. And of course, you know that we're to do a work of preaching the good news of God's coming kingdom, which is going to replace all of this mayhem and violence. There won't be any more grenades thrown. I was moved to tears a couple of times yesterday watching the speeches by men like Netanyahu, who I thought was very soulful and very personal in what he said, and in thinking about those little children and talking about their children's children. And I think King Hussein is a good-hearted man. I think he, of course, you can look at the fact that he could be overrun like that and he doesn't have much choice, but on the other hand, I think that at heart, I think he and his brother both want peace and want to coexist with the Israelis side by side. So I would wish, as an American, on the one hand, that peace could prevail over there, that we'd be given 3 or 5 or 10 years respite. I am not encouraged when I look at all of the potential problems built into that interim agreement, and I look at it in the light of biblical prophecy and what Christ himself says is going to occur in the Middle East, and I am still going to continue to be writing articles and be giving messages about the Middle East and what we can expect to occur over there. I think now, finally, I'll just conclude by saying, do you all know that not only are a lot of weirdos going to descend upon Israel, not only are 5 million Christian pilgrims going to be there, but the Pope is going to be there in 2000. 2000 is an artificial date. It has no significance spiritually, chronologically, or with regard to any calendar. But a lot of weirdos that think it is important are going to make it important by their actions, and of course we would be well advised to pay attention to what they're going to do. I just want to issue a disclaimer that I don't believe anybody ought to go there throwing any firebombs or trying to write any self-fulfilling prophecies, and let me tell you right now to conclude, if you hear in the next few weeks or so that somebody fed me something or somebody slipped me a pill and I come back in here and say I'm going to Jerusalem to die in the streets on January 1st, 2000, be sure not to follow me there. Go someplace far away as you can get.